This is the takeaway for Wednesday, February 7th, 2018.
It's the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's great to have you with us today. And we begin today in federal court in Baltimore, where the corruption trial of two police officers is in closing arguments. We've covered this trial before. The cops of the Gun Trace Task Force. These, you might remember, are the men allegedly involved in seizing drugs and guns, sending innocent people to jail, robbing civilians.
They would pop open a door in order to see who would run. And then they would run after that person, they would tackle him, and then they would search him. Drugs would go to the sergeant, in which he would then resell. And the money was then split up between all of the officers that were working that day. The sergeant of the unit would say that Hondas and Acuras are usually driven by what he would call dope boys. And so they would pull them over for no reason at all other than the car they were driving. Sneaking peeks. They would gain entry into homes before they would get a warrant to see if there was anything in the house worth stealing.
That's Brian Kubler, reporter for ABC affiliate WMAR-TV in Baltimore, describing just some of what Baltimore officers testified to in this trial. Shakedowns, robberies, theft of evidence, even carrying BB guns to plant on suspects if they were shot. It's become one of the biggest, certainly one of the most shocking police corruption scandals in U.S. history, and one that may have tainted up to 3,000 criminal cases, according to the Public Defender's Office. Six officers have already pleaded guilty in this case. Jane Miller has been following it all. She's an investigative reporter for WBAL-TV, and she's been covering the trial from the courtroom. Jane, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. Jane, today the court hears closing arguments before this case is sent to the jury. What are the charges against these two officers, Detectives Marcus Taylor and Daniel Herschel, the ones on trial here?
The charges center on a racketeering conspiracy that involved the crimes of robbery, robbery with a gun, extortion, overtime fraud, and obviously then the charges that involve betrayal of public trust. But this is a racketeering conspiracy that alleges that these officers used the power that they are granted as police officers to target people, steal from them, take their money, take their drugs, resell them for their own profit.
And Jane, we mentioned some of the shocking testimony over the last several weeks, the robberies, the thefts, framing of witnesses, shaking down.
Shocking to some.
Shocking to some. And we're going to hear in a moment from somebody in Baltimore for whom a lot of this testimony was not shocking, a public defender. That's coming up in a couple minutes. But there was some new testimony, Jane, about Detective Sean Souter, who was killed right before he was set to testify several months ago. What have we learned?
Well, Mamadou Gando was the fourth convicted police officer who was a member of the task force to testify, and he testified on Monday. Former Detective Gando testified that back in 2008 and 2009, when he was in a specialized unit, he and other officers, including former homicide detective Sean Souter, stole money from people. This was the first time since the death of Sean Souter that he has been implicated in the allegations of the Gun Trace Task Force. To this point, he was described as essentially an innocent bystander. Clueless, he was described in one indictment. He did work with these individuals over a number of years in these plainclothes units before moving to homicide.
And Sean Souter killed right before he was going to testify, and that murder, that homicide,
He was found fatally shot in West Baltimore on November 15th. On November 16th, he was to testify before the federal grand jury involving the corruption case.
And that,
from the beginning of the death of Sean Souter, there was an opinion among some investigators that it was not homicide, but a self-inflicted wound. I have reported that according to sources who are familiar with former Detective Souter in the recent months before his death, that he was showing some concern, even to the extent of some use the word distraught, about his upcoming testimony because he was concerned that he was going to be outed. We will never know what was in his mind on November 15th. There was no note that we know of, but certainly the revelations that came from former Detective Gando on Monday of this week cast whole new chapters in the case of Sean Souter.
Jane, we're talking about eight officers here, six who've pled guilty, two on trial now. But how far back does all of this go?
It's a real mistake to look at this case as a recent case. It was recently indicted in March of 2017. But as the case has gone on through evidence and testimony, it is very clear that these crimes did not start in 2014, as is charged in the indictments. These crimes stretch back to the mid-2000s at least. And the testimony and the additional evidence that has come forward exposes not just specific instances, but a real culture in the police department, in the Baltimore Police Department, that had higher-ups looking the other way, that had lots of rules being played fast and loose, and just flat-out criminal conduct under the shield of a police badge, subpoena power, search warrants, and a gun.
Jane Miller for WBAL-TV in Baltimore. Jane, thank you.
Thank you.
The corruption revealed in the Gun Trace Task Force trial in Baltimore came as no surprise to my next guest. Catherine Frey Balter is a former public defender in the Federal District of Maryland. She's now a law professor and a freelance writer, but in the past, she's represented hundreds of Baltimore's accused. Frey Balter says she has lots of cases where clients' federal indictments were based entirely on an officer's uncorroborated accounts, and that many of her clients spoke out about mistreatment, but no one listened.
You know, for too long in the halls of justice and in the courts of public opinion, there has been this presumption that the officer's word is sacrosanct, and the police word was too often uncorroborated and, worse, couldn't be corroborated. So what we had and what we will still have, unless there are changes, is the accused word versus the officer's word. And it just goes to the heart of our criminal justice system. How can we even begin to quantify what this does to a person? I mean, just think what it would be like to be locked up on false charges. It's the greatest deprivation imaginable. It's a categorical denial of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And how can that ever be compensated for?
Well, one thing you write about is the notion that this kind of corruption, these false statements planting evidence, all of the things we saw in the Gun Trace Task Force trial aren't limited to what the police chief described as a few bad apples. That's what he said. This is isolated. It's a small group of officers in Baltimore who were doing this. There's no systemic problem in Baltimore. And I don't think you buy it.
I don't. No one can say or should say with any confidence how far the rot goes. And it would be irresponsible to reflexively think that the line is drawn as narrowly as to these few charged officers. You know, we have decades of self-reports to counsel. There's volumes upon volumes of citizen complaints. Just 2 weeks ago in Baltimore City, an officer unrelated to the Gun Trace Task Force was indicted by a Baltimore City grand jury on charges including fabricating evidence. Just last night, I saw in the Baltimore Sun that during the course of the federal trial, 12 additional officers have been implicated in wrongdoing. Now, those accusations were made by officers and, I believe, one citizen who were testifying in this trial. And those officers are indeed have been indicted and have pleaded guilty. And there have been no findings with respect to those additional 12 people. But nonetheless, this is what we have. And that's why I think no one can or should say with any confidence that this is limited to a few bad apples. So we have to question, probe, and listen. Just in terms of going forward.
Well, you lay a serious charge as well in an editorial that I read by you that the riots that the nation watched after the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore lay at the feet of the Baltimore police. Why did you say that?
Let me give you the causal chain. It goes like this. One, looters stole from pharmacies and methadone clinics during the 2015 Freddie Gray riots as the world watched, as the country watched. Two, the officers confronted the looters and seized the stolen goods, the stolen drugs. So far, so good, right? But then three, instead of removing the drugs from the streets, as they are paid and sworn to do, the officers themselves, testimony revealed, the officers themselves engaged in a pervasive pattern of reselling, and they resold those very looted drugs to our city residents. While not relevant to the causal chain, but worth mention, the testimony revealed that during the course of the officer's enterprise, they profited in over $1 million from these sales. So fourth in the causal chain, the police department made an official statement blaming the looted drugs for the post-riot spike in crime. So I think the take-home we have here is that officers that we paid and trusted to keep us safe have been profiting from infusing our city, our community, with drugs, the very drugs which were blamed for the post-riot spike in crime. So our officers are the very drug dealers that they are entrusted to take off the streets. And in their dealing to those drugs to city residents, the infusion led, according to the Baltimore City Police Department, not me, to the spike in crime after the riots.
Well, Ms. Freibalter, you're asking, it seems to me, people to draw a direct connection from the disturbing and shocking testimony that we've seen in this trial over the last several days, weeks, and the guilty pleas over the last several months, to draw a line right from that to broad problems of police corruption, or even the broad problem of police brutality that the country's been fixated on for the last few years. Do you think that the country will do that? Will the country presume this is an isolated incident in Baltimore, and as Chief Souza said, a few bad apples? Or do you think America will start to take a broader lesson here?
We can only hope that America will draw the broader lesson. This corruption that we're seeing in trial is the price that we've paid for not listening. You know, the Black Lives Matter movement has been at the forefront. People of color in the front line have been sharing their experiences in courtrooms and in our streets. And all of these things show us why we must listen. I hope that this trial gets people to put themselves in the shoes of those who have been silenced for too long. You know, I'm sympathetic that if you're not a person of color, it's so hard to understand. But we need to understand what it's like to suffer the daily indignity of police misconduct. If you live in those neighborhoods, this has likely happened to you. You've suffered the indignity of police misconduct. If it hasn't happened to you, it's happened to your son or your husband or your uncle or most of your neighbors. So you understand, and too many of us don't understand this idea that officers could plant evidence or falsify a probable cause. Why would they do this? So I believe this case, if America is listening, if Baltimore is listening, this case puts our country in the shoes of those who have been silenced for too long.
Catherine Freibalter, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Professor Catherine Freibalter is a former public defender in the Federal District of Maryland. Let's go to Pennsylvania now, which in recent days has become the latest battleground in this spreading war over partisan gerrymandering in America. Pennsylvania's Supreme Court ordered Republicans who control the state legislature to redraw the Commonwealth's 18 congressional districts. Justices said the current map is contorted to give Republicans the edge in congressional races and said that Pennsylvania's map clearly, plainly, and palpably violates the state's constitution. Well, this week, Republicans went to the U.S. Supreme Court. They asked the court to step in. Justices refused. And now some Pennsylvania Republicans have suggested impeaching those state Supreme Court justices as a result of the ruling. Here's State Representative Chris Dush making the case last month.
They further do not have any semblance of authority under the contract to take on the mantle of sovereigns that is solely with the people and with the elected representatives. To attempt to do so is a prima facie evidence of an attempt to usurp the sovereignty of the people. I believe instead of just castigating the Supreme Court, I believe we should start the articles of impeachment.
With more on this case and what it means for gerrymandering in Pennsylvania and nationwide is Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. Emily, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
We will get to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's ruling and what gerrymandering looks like in Pennsylvania, Emily. But first, Chris Dush's argument there that the justices of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court should simply be impeached rather than Republicans complying with this ruling. Is he an outlier, or does this movement have any legs?
He is an outlier. I haven't seen any rush to join him among Pennsylvania Republicans. And obviously, impeachment is a strong remedy for a judicial decision that you don't like. It's also not entirely clear that Representative Dush understands how the law works here. He suggested that the court was going to draw the new districting lines itself. But in fact, what the court ordered was for the legislature to take a crack at drawing the lines. The governor would have to approve those lines. And only if that effort fails does the court appoint a special master to draw the lines. That's a pretty standard way for courts to handle redistricting disputes.
All right, so Chris Dush may be getting ahead of himself a little bit. But why did the Pennsylvania Supreme Court say that these 18 congressional districts violate the state constitution? What's wrong with them?
Well, the Pennsylvania Constitution, so right, every state has its own constitution. The Pennsylvania Constitution protects the right to vote. And the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said that it relied entirely on its own constitution in making this decision. A little surprisingly, the court hasn't issued a full opinion explaining its reasons. So we're a little in the dark about that. And that's a little odd, given that the initial ruling was a couple of weeks ago now. One expects that opinion any day. But it did make it clear that by February 15th, it expects a new map to be proposed by the legislature.
Well, how severe is the gerrymandering in Pennsylvania? They have 18 seats. Would Pennsylvania's delegation look significantly different without this gerrymandering, according to the courts?
Well, it could. So, right, we're talking about Pennsylvania's congressional delegation. Right now, there are 13 Republicans and 5 Democrats, even though Pennsylvania is famously a swing state, you know, tends to split down the middle for races like the president and for the governor, and did actually split down the middle when you look at all the votes for Congress in 2016. And yet you have this lopsided division. And so the redrawing of the line certainly could favor Democrats more than the current map. But, you know, Pennsylvania also has these geographical limitations. Pittsburgh and Philadelphia are where the vast majority of Democrats in the state live. And traditionally, when states draw lines, they try to keep cities more or less together. And so if the maps are drawn with that principle in mind, then I think you'd see a few of the congressional districts change in a way that would favor Democrats, but not necessarily like a huge shift that would completely transform the delegation.
Well, those shifting districts could be important in 2018 in the House. But Emily, GOP lawmakers here asked the Supreme Court to get involved, even though this is a state case. The Supreme Court refused, but partisan gerrymandering is definitely on their minds, the justices. There are cases in Wisconsin, North Carolina, Maryland. How does Pennsylvania fit into the broader legal war over gerrymandering?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There is a big legal battle over partisan gerrymandering. The Pennsylvania case is now sort of set off to the side because it was a Pennsylvania court relying on the Pennsylvania Constitution. Presumably, that's why the Supreme Court didn't decide to review it along with the other cases you mentioned. And so what will happen now is that within Pennsylvania, there will be a fight and continuing effort to work out their congressional districting lines. And in the meantime, the Supreme Court has cases from Wisconsin and Maryland before it, presumably will have a big ruling from the Supreme Court about partisan gerrymandering probably in June. And then the last part of this has to do with North Carolina, where the Supreme Court this week partially blocked a new map drawn there that affected the lines for the General Assembly elections in 2018. And so there will be continuing questions about that map, and the Supreme Court is now going to review that as well.
Well, but Emily, we're talking about the legal rulings. We have to talk about politics here because Democrats need 24 seats to regain control of the House in Washington. Historically, that's a long shot, but poll numbers suggest a Democratic wave in 2018. We don't know yet. But if more seats are in play with maps being redrawn in Pennsylvania and other places, what could that mean in the final analysis and Democrats' bid to try to take over?
Well, there's no question this is hugely important for all the reasons you just said, and it could determine the outcome of who's in control of the House. When every seat matters, then how lines are drawn and these questions about gerrymandering become incredibly important.
And looking across a big state like Pennsylvania with 18 seats in play, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Maryland, Pennsylvania is not alone. Their voters go to the polls and there will be plenty of voting. But if those districts change, there could be a lot more seats up in play than we previously thought.
That's right. And historically, what we've seen is a trend toward less and less competitive districts, right? Fewer and fewer, where partisan divides have become stronger. Republicans or Democrats tend to win by lopsided majorities in more places. But if states are forced to draw lines that don't have all this partisan gerrymandering, there will be more competitive elections for both Congress and state races. And that could be very healthy for the democracy.
And we'll see what the effect is on 2018 as well. Emily Bazelon, staff writer for the New York Times Magazine. Thanks, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
We go now to the recent string of deadly crashes for Amtrak. Last week, a train carrying GOP lawmakers struck a truck on the tracks in rural Virginia. One person was killed. Then on Sunday, a passenger train traveling from New York to Miami hit a stationary freight train in South Carolina, killing two people and injuring at least 116 others. It's the fourth fatal Amtrak incident in less than 2 months. There have been derailments, crashes, safety issues seem to be on the rise for Amtrak. There was the deadly crash outside Seattle that killed three people in December. Then just yesterday, two sections of an Amtrak high-speed Acela headed for New York's Penn Station from D.C. broke apart at 125 miles an hour. No one was injured in that incident. Bart Jansen is here, transportation reporter for USA Today. Bart, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Bart, is there a pattern here, and can we divine anything about what's going on with Amtrak?
Well, it does seem like a rash of accidents, but in each of the cases, the cause appears to be different. And so all of the investigations are still ongoing. But in each of the cases, you know, one, you have a grade level crossing where a vehicle is on the tracks. Most people wouldn't blame the railroad for that. On the South Carolina incident, a switch was set in such a way to direct the train directly into a freight train. And so they're investigating why the switch was set that way. And that's track that is not owned by Amtrak. It was owned by the freight company. But in Washington State, the engineer has told investigators that he missed a reduced speed limit sign. And so he headed into a 30 mile an hour curve at 80 miles an hour. So different causes, but yet a lot of attention focused on Amtrak lately.
Different causes. Investigators look at each one of these accidents by themselves. And then at what point do they try to draw lines between them, if there are any lines to be drawn?
Well, they absolutely look for comparisons. We just had a result of an investigation yesterday dealing with a local transit where had a couple of trains in different locations run into the poles at the ends of tracks, and they found commonality in that, which was sleep deprivation. The engineers were tired. So they will look for common themes. One common theme among Amtrak crashes has been the notion that Congress ordered railroads to install automatic braking technology called positive train control to try to slow down or stop trains if the engineer is not responsive. That might have prevented some of these crashes, but safety experts also warned that it wouldn't stop all of them, such as the garbage truck with the train with the Republican lawmakers on board. And in the South Carolina crash, the system was actually turned off as they upgraded the track for this technology. So it's not the be-all, end-all, but it is one thing that safety experts, Congress, all agree they would like to see installed.
We'll stress again that positive train control wouldn't prevent all of these accidents that we're talking about, Bart Jansen. But in the meantime, before this technology is nationwide, is anyone getting a big picture handle on how to improve safety at Amtrak?
Well, the newest CEO, Richard Anderson, just took control of the railroad. He comes from the airline industry. He was a longtime executive at Delta. And he is promoting safety as the railroad's top priority. He says he wants to improve the culture of safety there. But as we see, there are training problems, miscommunications, and perhaps even mechanical problems, such as we saw with the cars uncoupling yesterday on the Acela. So they have some work to do. But from the top, the new CEO, Anderson, does want to instill a culture of better safety on the railroad.
Well, that Acela uncoupled between New York and D.C. yesterday, Bart Jansen, at 125 miles an hour in the morning. I was on that very line later in the afternoon, and I can tell you, passengers were talking about it, even in the quiet car.
Yes, I mean, these accidents and incidents are rare, but particularly with the fatal accidents, catastrophic. The 2015 accident, which killed 8 people in Philadelphia, criminal charges were restored yesterday against the engineer. Amtrak and its insurers settled for $265 million in that crash because even the survivors, some were terribly injured. A chef was made quadriplegic in that accident. So the accidents are rare, and we could go over those statistics, but when they happen, they are catastrophic.
Bart Janssen, transportation reporter for USA Today. Bart, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I paid a severance because I cared about her.
That was Republican Congressman Pat Meehan of Pennsylvania last month explaining why he used taxpayer money to settle a sexual harassment claim brought by a former staffer. Now, you heard it there. Meehan was careful to say his payments to the ex-staffer were severance, not a settlement. But records do show that $300,000 in taxpayer money was used to settle 13 sexual harassment complaints between 2003 and 2017 in Congress. Now, Meehan isn't running for re-election. Other high-profile cases include Michigan Democratic Congressman John Conyers, who stepped down in December, and Republican Congressman Blake Farenthold of Texas, who also isn't running for re-election after reporting revealed that he settled a sexual harassment complaint with $84,000 in House funds. Well, now, this week, the GOP-controlled House passed new legislation aimed at overhauling workplace harassment rules in its ranks. Here with more, Alana Shore, congressional reporter for Politico. Alana, thanks for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this new legislation in the House, Alana, it passed easily. What are the new rules?
Well, this is a lot, Todd. Primarily, it would create what we call an Office of Employee Advocacy. Now, the House already has an Employment Counsel's Office that has a team of lawyers known to be real bulldogs representing the members. And it's these lawyers who are at the table with the often young aides saying, you got to sign a non-disclosure agreement, you've got to settle for this amount. The victim, until now, has never had his or her own counsel. That is what the Office of Employee Advocacy would do. Beyond that, the other top lines. If a lawmaker like Meehan is paying up for a sexual harassment settlement, it can't come from public money. It's got to come garnished out of his own wages. And there's specific procedures to go after lawmakers who won't pay up. Other changes. The Office of Compliance, which is the obscure office that had previously handled these complaints, would be renamed the Office of Congressional Workplace Rights, would have investigative and subpoena powers that it lacks now, and would report every 6 months on the awards that it's dispersing.
What about rules on relationships between members of Congress or senior staff and lower level staff?
You bet. That's another one. Members of Congress would be barred from having relationships with staff members they supervise. However, not in other offices.
So, Alana, talk a little bit about how revelations of sexual harassment and the Me Too movement have hit Congress. Now we have these new rules. But this institution is insular. It tends not to radically change its rules based on what's going on off of Capitol Hill. Why did things happen, at least in the House, so quickly here?
That's a really great question, because what also doesn't happen in the House these days is any bipartisan collaboration.
Right.
But here you have a bill that was written by a Philadelphia and San Francisco Democrat working with an Alabama and Mississippi Republican, and these members acknowledged it. Under any other circumstance, they would not be able to agree on this stuff. And I think it happened for two reasons. Number one, the wave of scandals that hit both parties. John Conyers was a Democrat. Pat Meehan was a Republican. It really forced both parties to see that they had their own internal issues with this. Number two, I think some of these members were genuinely surprised at how poorly their own system was designed at this point. It just hadn't kept pace with the modern era. So there was this real genuine desire to make it better.
Well, outside of the rules, Alana, what about the culture change among members and powerful senior staff in Congress? Would you say that the message has sunk in here that if you harass someone in the workplace in Congress, it could be a career ender? Is that going to be a deterrent?
I think it has, but I wouldn't describe it as a message so much as a fear. And part of that is because Capitol Hill is filled with really ambitious people who all come from wildly different backgrounds representing different areas. And one of the earliest issues we had with sexual harassment on the Hill, I actually sat for the training video that's distributed as the main, you know, deterrent policing mechanism to these offices, the video's not always that clear. You know, certain issues around the office can be somewhat subjective. Certain managers may think, oh, I was being very encouraging when I physically touched my employee. So I think that cultural change has yet to really sink in. Maybe it will. The video has recently been redone. Maybe that will just take some time. I do think right now the fear is real. These members see what their colleagues encountered, and people will behave very differently.
Alana Shore, congressional reporter for Politico. Alana, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The government in Israel has announced plans to deport tens of thousands of Eritrean and Sudanese refugees. Alon Lior is an immigration correspondent in Tel Aviv for Haaretz, and he says that while this controversial approach to African refugees and asylum seekers may be new in Israel, it's also the culmination of a dilemma that's divided that country for over a decade now.
It started more than 10 years ago when African asylum seekers started crossing the border from Egypt to Israel. There was no fence at that time, and about 65,000 of them crossed the border and stayed in Israel. Now we have about 40,000 left, since about 25,000 have left in recent years following massive pressure from the Israeli government.
Alon Lior of Haaretz there on the influx that led Israel to these decisions. And I asked Alon to explain the government's new approach and the political moment.
Several months ago, the Israeli government decided to change its policy. It plans to deport African asylum seekers either back to their country or to what they call here in Israel third countries, which are neutral countries in Africa. There are two countries which African asylum seekers were sent to in recent years, and those are Rwanda and Uganda. They will be given a choice either to leave to one of those countries I mentioned or to go to jail for an indefinite period of time.
Well, we'll talk about those deportations in just 1 minute. I want to talk about the policy up until last week, Ilan, basically making life so tough on these asylum seekers that they would leave as voluntarily as you can leave after having life made difficult for you. What was Israeli policy like up until last week?
Israel was putting massive pressure on them. For example, they have to renew their visas every 2 months. And they have to stand in very long queues sometimes, spend a whole day, and wait just to renew their visas. Their visa is just a piece of paper, and it says on it that they're not allowed to work in Israel. Even though the Supreme Court ruled that Israel can't deny them the opportunity to work, so Israel accepted it and said that it won't try and deny it from them, but officially they're not allowed to work. So a lot of employers use it in order to pay them less money, and a lot of employers are afraid to employ them as well. So that's one thing. A second thing I can mention, and it was very influential here in Israel, was about 4 years ago, the Israeli government decided to build an open detention center in the south of Israel, in the desert, isolated. African asylum seekers, and only African asylum seekers, were sent there randomly. It means when they got to the immigration authority to renew their visas, they were told you have to be there in 1 month. If you don't go there, we're going to put you in jail. And that open detention center wasn't really a place they could have a normal life. It's somewhere very isolated in Israel. They had no money with them. They could not work. And they generally spent their time in a almost prison-like facility.
But Alon, isn't there a third choice? Can't Israel process some of these asylum claims and allow entry to people if they face persecution at home?
Yeah, that's what the people opposing these plans are saying. They're calling Israel to process asylum claims, to check them one by one, decide who should get protection here in Israel and give them all the rights they deserve, and opportunity to work, and housing, and social benefits. We should say that there are about 15,000 out of 40,000 African asylum seekers left in Israel. 15,000 actually filed a specific asylum request, told their story, and only 11 of them were recognized so far by Israel as refugees, and those are the lowest recognition rates in the Western world when it comes to asylum seekers from Eritrea and Sudan.
So that number, 11, Ilan, how does that wash in Israeli society? Israel is a country born out of Jewish persecution in Europe. It has it in its DNA. It has the Holocaust at the core of its founding. How does this treatment of asylum seekers to its own country play out in Israeli society now?
Yeah, you're right. And people are saying now, we cannot do the same things that were done to us after the Holocaust, when a lot of countries refused to accept Jewish refugees. And now we're doing the same thing to Africans, which are in danger in their home countries. And we're refusing to give them an opportunity to live somewhere safe. There was even a petition signed by Holocaust survivors in Israel a couple of weeks ago that said they are against the deportation, and Israel should try and give these people protection and an opportunity to live in a normal place. Other people say that Israel is a very small country, and it cannot afford itself to have so many foreigners live here. And at least the government claims that most of these people are not real refugees. It calls them infiltrators, even work infiltrators. That's the terminology the Israeli government uses. And they are not real refugees that are running away from a bitter destiny in their home countries. And that's the public debate that's going on here in Israel.
And this position of the Netanyahu government that these are work infiltrators, is there a political price to pay for that policy, or does a majority of Israeli society agree with it?
According to polls that were made here last week by a TV channel and a newspaper, the majority of the Israeli population actually supports the government's plan to deport African asylum seekers. There is a big number of people, around a third of the population, which is against it, but most of them are not Netanyahu voters. They're not the right-wing voters. Most of the people that support the government support this plan as well.
So, Ilan, as we take a step back during this global refugee crisis, where does this put Israel's role as a democracy during this massive international migration wave?
I think Israel, in a way, is very similar to other countries that's trying to close its borders now and not receive any refugees or migrants. And Israel's claiming it's a very small country, less than 9 million people, and it cannot handle a large number of refugees or migrants. But you need to remember the numbers in Israel are comparably small when you compare it to Europe, for example, which countries there are getting hundreds of thousands of refugees a year. We only have 40,000 African asylum seekers in Israel. So a lot of people are claiming it is a number Israel can deal with, and it's still refusing to do it. I think the Israeli government is very similar maybe to the Trump administration as well, which does not want to accept a large number of refugees and sees a lot of them as work migrants, which it has no obligation to accept or to receive these days.
Ilan Lior, immigration correspondent for Haaretz in Israel. Ilan, thanks.
Thank you, Todd.
Let's take a minute now and talk about happiness, your happiness. This is a new project we have here on The Takeaway. Every week in February, we're partnering with the new podcast, The Science of Happiness, to look at some of the techniques that scientists are studying to train our brains for basic emotions like happiness. Think of it as self-help if you want, but this is hardcore neuroscience. So this week, we're looking at the Three Good Things experiment. It works like this. Every day, you write down three things that went well in your life.
A stranger gave me their seat on the subway.
The sound of my six-month-old baby laughing just makes everything better.
Today, I found a plant I'd been wanting for a really long time at a local market.
Really, it can be anything. For this first experiment, freelance journalist Shuka Kalantari took the challenge.
I was tasked as the happiness guinea pig to spend about 15 minutes or more, but at least 15 minutes a day, to reflect about three good things that have happened to me that day. And not just reflect, but physically write them down.
Shuka reported her results to Dacher Keltner. He's a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley and host of the new podcast, The Science of Happiness.
Shuka's a local journalist that's worked with the Greater Good Science Center on some gratitude work that we did. And she was our first happiness guinea pig. And so she did the three good things exercise, where you take 15 minutes, you go to a quiet place, and you think about three good things that are happening in your life. And it was really striking, and you'll hear it. It kind of slowed time down for her.
So the first thing I reflected upon was a day a few weeks ago when my husband, my son, and I just spent a few hours alone, the three of us, at the Berkeley Marina, throwing pebbles into the water.
All right, let's get a handful of rocks. Now let's throw them in the water. Ready? One, two, three.
And it just gave her a feeling of appreciation. And that corresponds to a lot of the science on this simple practice, which is not only does it enhance well-being, but it tends to make you savor things and feel like you have a little bit more time in the day.
I definitely did slow down and savor it. And furthermore, it made me stop and think, okay, I have to do three good things today, or there has to be three good things in my life today. Is there any way I can make room for a good thing myself?
So it was a really revealing exercise.
Well, for every happiness guinea pig in the Science of Happiness podcast, Stacker, you've got a neuroscientist who comes in to help Sherpa them through the experience. Tell us about the scientist that joins Shuka on your first podcast. And I'm really interested in this concept of hedonic adaptation.
Yeah, you know, the mind is full, whether we like it or not, of paradoxes, right? And hedonic adaptation is this idea that's been bouncing around in the Science of Happiness literature, and your listeners will be really familiar with it, which is that, regrettably, we have this capacity to adapt to and get used to things that change in our lives, right? And as a result, the things that bring us intense joy initially, we adapt to them, and then we eventually, it loses its positive impact. We adapt hedonically.
When things are the same, when stimuli are constant, when things are familiar, then we don't tend to notice them or pay attention to them very, very much. And sort of the downside of that is that when a relationship becomes kind of familiar, you know, and constant over time, when there's not a lot of change or surprise, or when a job becomes familiar, or when your new car becomes very familiar to you, then we start taking them for granted, and then we sort of stop paying attention to them, and that's when we have adapted.
And so for this first episode, Sonia Lubomirsky, who's really one of the pioneers in the science of happiness, has, based on this idea of hedonic adaptation, that we start to take for granted the things that are good, she's scientifically studied all these ways in which you can counter hedonic adaptation. You can, you know, practice three good things. You can say thank you to people who matter to you. You can practice loving kindness, right? Just little discipline practices that countervail the forces of hedonic adaptation.
Well, this is just fascinating, Dacher. The science of training your brain for happiness. I love it. Well, we put some of our listeners on the case here, and we asked you, listeners, to try the three good things exercise. Here's how it went for some of you.
My name is Renee Hernandez, Morgantown, West Virginia.
Hi, my name is Catherine from Portland, Oregon.
This is Patrick McNally. I'm in Jacksonville, Florida.
Three things that helped you be happy today. Just one is laughter.
I just sent a beautiful sprig of fragrant Daphne that's blooming here to my sister. I thought that would give her hope.
That my friend came and helped me because my alternator is bad in my old car.
My wife and I share three things that we're grateful for every night when we go to bed. It can be big things, little things, but we always make an effort.
And that my landlord is going to let me hold my rent check so that I can get the alternator replaced in my car.
Spring is coming.
Well, the three good things sounds like a success for a lot of you. And Dacher, we want to invite listeners once again to take part in another one of your happiness exercises. Next week, we're looking at 36 questions for increasing closeness. Now, this is going to air on Valentine's Day. Can you tell us a little bit about these 36 questions and how people can give it a try?
So, you know, Todd, when you look at the science of happiness, and sociologists and psychologists have been writing about this for a long time, which is what really jumps out is people feel like they don't have as much closeness and connection in their lives as they would like. You know, 30% of Americans report, as John Cacioppo has found, that they're really lonely. We feel a little bit distant from people that we love, and you know, we're working harder than ever before, and teens are stressed out and the like. And so what the 36 questions does, and it was developed by psychologist Art Aaron, is you just pause, you take 40 minutes, And it's almost like a parlor game where you ask the person that you're with, a friend, a romantic partner, a family member. There's new research doing this with people who are just becoming friends. You ask them a bunch of questions, like, you know, and they start off kind of sort of fun and lighthearted, and then they get really serious. Like, you know, do you ever sing to yourself? Do you, Todd?
Go constantly, Dacher, all the time.
So there we go. We're off and running, right? And then it gets into these existential questions like, do you have a secret hunch about how you might die, right? So there are 36 of these questions, and they just get people to start revealing themselves, learning about others and laughing and looking at each other in the eye and feeling compassion and so forth. And the studies show that, you know, just doing this exercise makes you feel closer to romantic partners, strangers, people of different ethnic backgrounds. It just brings you closer in the way that great conversation and listening tends to do.
Well, it just might be the perfect exercise for the mid-February time of year. People can get all the information on our website at thetakeaway.org to participate in the 36 questions and the next installment of the Science of Happiness podcast with Dacher Keltner. Dacher, you'll be back with us next week, so we'll talk to you then.
I'm looking forward to it, Todd. Thanks for having us.
Great to have you. Dacher Keltner, professor of psychology at UC Berkeley and host of the Science of Happiness podcast from the Greater Good Science Center and Public Radio International. Well, before we go for the day, we want to hear from you on an upcoming story that we're working on. Jessica Bennett of the New York Times and Koa Beck of Jezebel join us every week to talk about gender issues and the Me Too moment here on The Takeaway. And we want to hear from the men who've been listening out there. What thoughts do you have about this moment? What questions? Have you rethought any of your own behavior? Do you think that parts of Me Too have gone too far? Wherever you stand, we want your questions and your thoughts, and we'll bring them to Jessica and Koa in an upcoming segment. Our number is 8778-MY-TAKE. Again, that's 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us your questions and your thoughts at The Takeaway. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.